Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Coming up on this show, it's a big week for retailers, both large and small. We'll also talk about a high-profile court case in Dollar General with some headline-making news. We'll talk about seasonality as we head towards July 4th as well with a story about fireworks retail. Please rate us. Remember, however you find us weekly, those five-star ratings help others find us. Also, giving us any kind of feedback whatsoever assists us in piecing together this show. Check us out on Twitter and Instagram as well, at Retail Podcast. Just posted a story this week about Lidl, a high-profile research firm, coming out with data that suggests that Lidl may not be making the impact in their markets that was once thought. Has something to do perhaps with last week's story about Lidl abandoning some development agreements. But from that to another grocer, as we begin today's show with Kroger. The company saw its shares rise over 9% in trading on Thursday on the back of inventory management and online sales. Kroger's been on the digital bandwagon for years now, despite what you might read about Kroger reinvesting in digital only after Amazon bought Whole Foods. Kroger's been rolling out things like their ClickList program for years. And those investments in data, mobile, and omnichannel infrastructure are now paying dividends. Leighton, you and I have both been bullish on Kroger, even though their stock price has been all over the map over the last 3 years, highs over 40, lows below 20. I'm a Kroger shareholder. I got in at about $21. I was smiling this week, and I know between the two of us, we kind of reassured a lot of our listeners that, look, Kroger's not going anywhere. They've got the infrastructure. They've got the digital initiatives, and they showed it finally in this earnings call and kind of bore out that optimism that us and a few others in the grocery space saw.
Luckily, there are a lot of people like us that look at grocery as an industry that is still trying to evolve, trying to maintain a certain balance. And Kroger, for their long storied history in the United States, is still looked at, again, by most people as a grocery staple, but one that is more or less stagnant in the face of Walmart, Amazon, and Target's big grocery push, at least in terms of those media headlines. A lot of people are saying that Walmart, Target, Amazon, that is the wave of the future for the grocery business, but that is not the case. Kroger is a powerhouse and continues to expand through all of the initiatives that Trent just outlined. It was just the last week when we talked about the major struggles that Lidl has faced on the East Coast. And we have to remember that all of those analysts that had said that Lidl was going to be taking over and taking a huge bite into Kroger's market share and be a bigger force than Aldi long term, a lot of those analysts are now backpedaling. And some of those same analysts are saying that Kroger is looking to give Walmart a run for its money, as well as Amazon, with their two-hour shipping initiatives that are circulated around grocery in a certain number of regions. But Whole Foods, for their part, has reduced some prices, but we have not seen any major unit expansion there or sales expansion from what we have gathered from Amazon's latest quarterly report. So Kroger is still number one in the face of the competition that we just outlined. And we look at those first quarter results and we see that they beat in nearly every figure. Kroger's net income hit $2 billion and the adjusted net income figure hit $626 million. Both the adjusted and unadjusted profit figures were higher than 2017's numbers. The results were higher than what the company had previously guided for and expected for the first quarter. Much of this internal beat had to do with the aggressive cost controls that also coincided with the Restock Kroger program that is, of course, their all-encompassing objective to be fully omnichannel, compete on price, and drive some of their now ubiquitous private label brands like Simple Truth. Adjusted earnings per share hit 73 cents. That beat analyst expectations by about 10 cents per share. Total sales increased 3.4% to $37.5 billion for the first quarter compared to $36.3 billion this time last year. Same store sales with the convenience store divestment. Remember, they sold off 800 of their convenience stores, and excluding their remaining fuel station sales were around 2.8%. So not too shabby there. We remember here that divesting those standalone locations were part of their larger vision to be more focused on their current larger supermarket base and be a little bit more operationally disciplined with those. Kroger reported identical supermarket sales without fuel of 1.4% for the first quarter in 2018. What we normally call same-store sales, they call ID sales for identical store sales. We see that calculating identical sales is going to be different for the company moving forward, as typically in the past, they don't often include their Kroger specialty pharmacy or ship-to-home solutions streams of revenue. Kroger's identical sales without fuel were 1.9% for the first quarter. The company said they will look to use this calculation going forward to include more appropriate measures to track Kroger's performance as it redefines their business strategy. So they're going to be looking to include more of the digital sales as far as their identical store sales metric is concerned.
And speaking of those digital sales, they grew 66%, which was the highlight for many, including a lot of analysts that cover Kroger. CEO Rodney McMullen said on the call that they have confidence overall in their long-term vision. He's been saying this for a few years now. And he said that vision will be met through food inspiration and uplift. He noted that they want to be the best full-service grocery experience in America. It would be odd if he didn't say that. But investment in their employees was a big topic on the call, and it's paying off in terms of retention rates, which in turn are building margins because this lowers training and hiring expenses in the long term. $500 million, in fact, investment in associate wages, 401k match increase, and tuition reimbursement of up to $3,500 per year for associates that have been with the company for 6 months or longer. All of these were rolled out in an effort to retain those employees and advance employees through the company, reducing the number of positions they have to fill overall. ClickList expansion was also a major component for their digital sales increases, as it was a major topic on the earnings call. Other parts of that double-digit increase for their digital sales, that 66% increase, were delivery and year-over-year growth with current digital shoppers. So their digital shoppers 1 year ago, they're spending more and they're going digital more often today. ClickList obviously ties into their strategy of providing customers the ability to shop for anything, anywhere, and anytime. They spoke of their planned merger as well with Home Chef, the meal delivery kit service, and the enthusiasm that that team can bring to the table. Kroger's meal kits that have already existed now for about a year and a half will be fully integrated with Home Chef going forward. They view, Kroger does, Home Chef is the more innovative solution, also a stronger brand when it comes to meal prep kits. They'll be able to leverage that innovation with the scaled approach that Kroger has with their entire distribution and supplier network. Now, management, as we know, they've been super aggressive in rolling out ClickList. And if you look at Kroger's marketing, whether that be via billboards, whether that even be on the car that they sponsor in NASCAR, ClickList is everywhere. No longer are they pushing the groceries, the freshness of the groceries. They're pushing ClickList as a way to get people to shop digitally and get them hooked to those online channels. And as we talked in an interview a couple of weeks ago with a Cardlytics grocery analyst, it takes about 5 to 8 times to get someone tied into that digital format of shopping. And that's one of the reasons why Kroger has been aggressive in marketing and rolling out this ClickList program. They need to get to that 5 to 8 mark such that it becomes a habit for that consumer and they don't stray elsewhere. They claim currently to have nearly 75% of their physical store customers able to have some sort of digital-facing platform, whether that's ClickList or home delivery. And Layton, private label sales also keep growing. 28.7% of units sold currently at Kroger are private label. That's a 3.4% bump that's also giving them strength against other grocers, Lidl being one of those grocers, especially in the Southeast. As a percentage of sales, this represents almost 27% of sales. So 27% of sales at Kroger come from those private label brands, and a huge gross margin boost they got this last quarter with Simple Truth, which is their organics and all-natural selection in terms of their private label brand.
Lastly, as far as their initiatives are concerned, they claim to have more data than any other competitor. And we just talked about their competitors earlier in Walmart, Amazon, Target. All three of those, every time they have an earnings report, all they talk about is data. So it's interesting here that they're saying that their number one competitive advantage here is the data that they have in-house. This allows, they think, for personalization and for future delivery optionality, because they say that another key differentiator that Kroger has is the fact that they have a close proximity to their core customer base. They said the majority of their customers, around 80% or so, are within 1 to 2 miles of a physical location. So if you want to talk about delivery windows and how they can shorten those, managing and having all of that data available will certainly be helpful and to try to push back the Amazon 2-hour delivery window, or oftentimes the 1 to 2 hour that Walmart has been talking about in certain regions of the country. Despite all of that investment, they are confident that the Restock Kroger program will generate around $6.5 billion in free cash flow over the next 3 years. You have to keep in mind, they are a publicly traded company, so at the end of the day, you have to bring a lot of money to that bottom line to keep shareholders happy, because you can offer every initiative possible, but it doesn't make much sense if it doesn't bring a return for the major investors. This is taking into consideration a new corporate tax rate, higher wages that are going to be put forth through that investment, and lower purchase prices for many of their goods. So they are still investing into the costs that a lot of the customers see when it comes to the staple goods in their stores. They said, and they noted, that they have steadily reduced prices for many of their goods over the last 18 years, saved customers around $4 billion is what they said from all of the data that they've aggregated. Inventory management and efficiencies within store storage and digital sales will also help the bottom line. They're getting a little bit more efficient with those omni-channel infrastructure plans. They're saying that a lot of the inventory is getting managed a lot better. You're not having to really split off the supply chain in order to fulfill those customers that are coming to shop conventionally and those shoppers that are shopping digitally. Shareholders should be happy, not just because the bump in the stock price on Thursday to over $28 a share, but also the fact that the company continues to use capital to buy back a substantial amount of shares. They bought back around 110 million shares and they issued $442 million in dividends. They are adding slightly more shareholder value than they are reinvesting. So in terms of capital expenditure versus share buybacks and dividends, it's about 55-45 in terms of the piece of the pie and in terms of managing that cash flow for the company. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on Thursday that states, if they so choose, can force some e-commerce retailers to charge sales tax. And this is a story that we've been talking about for months now. The decision was made up of a 5-4 split. Historically, of course, states were prevented from charging sales tax on a variety of purchases from companies that did business outside of their state. Collections usually did occur if retailers had distribution out of the same state in which they sold a product to a particular customer that resided in the state that the item was shipped. Amazon customers will note that they've paid sales tax on many items over the years, particularly items either fulfilled by Amazon or coming directly from Amazon themselves. Additionally, stores with buy online, pick up in-store options have long charged sales tax since nothing is being shipped across state lines and fulfillment is on the hands of the consumer. A couple months ago, Trent, on the podcast, we talked about the impending lawsuit between South Dakota and Wayfair that was brought forth, alleging that there were major budget deficits because they were losing out on tax revenue from online purchases, not just from Wayfair.com, but a number of major retailers.
South Dakota's attorney general in this case went so far as to say that the current system of taxation hurt schools and state-run infrastructure, and that the retailers that operated online were unfairly competing against those that were brick and mortar. Now, it bears mentioning that South Dakota, one of the states without a state income tax, but unlike a state like Texas, where there's no state income tax, they don't have quite the tourism that Texas brings in. And of course, you don't have the size of state, you don't have the population, you don't have a lot of that stuff where you can bring in, say, property taxes from the outside. So this money is especially important to a state like South Dakota, who said they could get $34 billion a year more in revenue if they collected taxes. Now, obviously, that's money that would probably be lost in another consumer transaction or investment, or at least a lot of it would be. So it's kind of hard to gauge whether that $34 billion is an accurate figure. After all, a person's tax savings, if you're saving 8%, let's say, on a sale online, that's got to go someplace, and it usually goes to other consumer spending, which may or may not end up leading to more state revenue. So in other words, if a person incurs, let's say, an 8% tax in online sales, it's likely that they'll just spend 8% less with e-commerce retailers or brick-and-mortar retailers overall, rather than dig into their discretionary spending for the extra 8%. This may not apply to an individual purchase, but when looking at purchases over the span of a year or more for a particular consumer or family, it certainly would. We can't assume that families are just going to spend 8% more because of the ability to collect state sales tax for these online retailers. Now, Amazon has been the main target, even though they pay sales tax in all but five states. The issue that many are forgetting regarding Amazon is that in many cases, their third-party sellers often don't have to collect this sales tax. Regardless, there are many arguments that have gone both ways. Politically, Republicans, of course, want low taxes, low barriers to start a business, and open markets. However, President Trump said on Thursday that the court's ruling will be, and I quote, a great victory for consumers. Now, we should note that Trump has appeared in the past through tweets and comments to be a bit anti-Amazon, or at least anti-Jeff Bezos. We're not sure, looking at this, how this is a win for consumers, or is blatant of a win for consumers, as he seems to believe. It will most likely benefit state governments and also local brick-and-mortar stores the most. If potentially this has enough publicity surrounding it, it might push more sales into the brick-and-mortar forum, but we're really not sure what type of impact it will have, other than maybe removing some of that discretionary spending money that families have because you've got that 8% sales tax. We do know that state governments, though, the unequivocal winner in this circumstance. Now, the counter argument is one that says that customers, as I've alluded to, will not only pay more because of being taxed more, but the cost of doing business as a retailer will go up because of the increased accounting costs and attorney's fees as they figure out exactly how state and local taxes are assessed in all the different areas of the country. It's likely that a lot of e-commerce retailers are going to have to go with third-party systems to keep track of this. So in theory, this will either cause them to profit less or pass the added expense on to their consumers, which would make it more expensive. Therefore, also for small businesses or entrepreneurs thinking of bringing a product to market to actually bring that product to market, and would make Amazon perhaps the biggest winner because, again, they already collect taxes. And I can tell you from owning a business that has to pay sales tax in multiple different states or collect sales tax in multiple different states, just that alone, doing that manually is a headache. So unless you have the infrastructure in place, if you're an e-commerce startup, this might be fairly difficult. And Amazon businesses, those third-party sellers we talked about, will likely be eating the cost of tax collection here because purchase prices are so competitive and tight on Amazon that even a few cents can make a difference. So it might end up hurting a lot of those third-party sellers as well.
This is an interesting dynamic because you have to look at why this was brought forth to begin with, or at least a lot of the reasons why a lot of people, a lot of politicians have been talking about it. Again, sentiments like being anti-Amazon. Amazon, like we mentioned months ago, will actually have the ability to offer accounting services and networking power through AWS, something they've long been doing for their third-party sellers and a lot of the companies they actually compete with that don't sell on the Amazon retail platform. So sellers are going to have to either rely on that or rely on something similar to move forward if this were to stay in place. Amazon will end up getting yet another boost from a different revenue stream as a result. So this ends up being a win-win for Amazon because Amazon, for their part, has already been paying taxes for the majority of the states in the United States. And they will now be getting this additional revenue stream from AWS or their accounting services. So for companies to individually collect and pay taxes on their e-commerce sales would require a massive infrastructure investment. And we see that a lot of companies are already trying to take advantage of this, offering their services to startup companies or companies that are fairly small in the e-commerce industry. However, businesses with brick and mortar locations in many states already, like Walmart, Home Depot, Lowe's, Target, may not be facing an enormous obstacle because they already have existing e-commerce infrastructure needed to accommodate the ruling. So really, this is not going to hurt the major retailers. This isn't even going to hurt Wayfair.com, which is how this was brought forth to begin with from South Dakota. Trump went on to tweet earlier this week that this is also a big win, big victory for retailers, but that we take that to mean brick and mortar retailers who do little business online. Again, this is mostly going to help the brick and mortar stores, as Trent had alluded to. The issue was raised to the Supreme Court primarily because of state budget shortfalls, not necessarily because of unfairness. A lot of people were prefacing this argument in a number of different ways. Consumers will undoubtedly still shop online as they did before for the convenience factor. We talk about shipping all of the time and how fulfillment centers are getting more efficient. We know that customers are already okay with paying a premium for some items that are going to be delivered, like groceries, which we can often see double-digit price hikes for those delivery options. And we look at some of the justification behind this ruling. Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote that he believed that it was a true disadvantage to brick-and-mortar retailers doing business versus their e-commerce competitors. The original 1967 Supreme Court ruling had to do with mail order businesses and not online businesses, obviously, because that didn't start taking off until the late 90s. And the thought at the time was that those mail order businesses would never be able to attain such a large market share in any particular niche of the retail market. The internet is obviously doing much bigger and better things in business than any mail order catalog once did in the 60s, so the competition should be looked at a little bit closer, says Justice Kennedy's opinion. In 1992, there was a clarification that a retailer with a physical presence in a state would have to collect from that state with mail order. So obviously this is how it is currently structured, in that if you have a distribution, a warehouse, or any other physical presence as far as a retail storefront is concerned, and you make a sale to somebody who resides in that state, you have to have that tax collected. Chief Justice John Roberts, who usually votes in favor of Republican Party ideals, gave a dissenting opinion. He said that changes to any rules regarding e-commerce may hinder the continued growth in this sector of the economy. So basically, he's ruling that the 1992 ruling was or should be able to stay in place. The thought here being, from John Roberts, is that e-commerce giants have helped consumers pay significantly lower prices. It's been an increase in competition overall, so the consumer has obviously been winning out, but also there's been significant economic creation. A lot of new jobs have been created, and there's been a lot of innovation that has helped boost the economy overall. Overall, you see that there's been a low barrier to entry, so a lot of smaller businesses that are looking to come up and sell products in the online realm may stop, think about it for a second, and decide to maybe do something else with their capital.
In the end, we should keep in mind that this ruling doesn't necessarily state that states should or are required to collect sales tax. It's only giving the options to the state to require sales tax. And so states may decide in the future to only levy sales tax on online retailers of a certain size, leaving smaller ones out of the mix. Additionally, we should keep in mind that not every state has a food sales tax, so some companies like Brandless and Thrive Market, for example, wouldn't have to collect much tax in those particular states other than on maybe cleaning supplies or HBA products. So that infrastructure would need to be in place, but it wouldn't impact consumers quite as much. So much may stay the same overall for larger retailers that are already collecting state taxes. We've talked about the likes of Lowe's, Home Depot, Target, and Walmart. Wayfair.com, as Leighton mentioned, they said they're already collecting on 80% of its U.S. business, and management there said there'll be little noticeable effect on its business overall. The former CEOs of Sears Canada, Toys R Us, and in addition, Ron Johnson of JCPenney, all applauded the Supreme Court decision, saying that it should have an impact on brick-and-mortar retailers and their decisions going forward. Now, Ron Johnson made the media rounds this week, and let us note that we're usually extremely critical of Ron Johnson, and much of his analysis, even post-JCPenney tenure, has been misguided or off the mark. And that's before you get into his JCPenney tenure, where he drove the company into quite a large rut. However, he's correct in that this may have just a slight positive impact on brick and mortar. Some former leaders did say, though, that they expected e-commerce growth to be on the same growth track. And it's something we feel will be the case. It's still an industry that's yet to mature, with that's borne out by the growth numbers. And I don't know that the presence of state sales tax on purchases is going to have that large of a negative effect on the e-commerce industry. Now, as with everything, only time will tell if this ends up doing more harm than good for retailers that are on the cusp of growth, and if this gives larger, more established retailers a leg up on their competition But one thing is for sure, states like South Dakota will likely end up with more money in their coffers, and that may end up impacting retail too. If you think about the $34 billion that South Dakota mentioned, even if it's only a fraction of that, say $15 billion, something like that could really improve transportation in a state. When you think about improved transportation, you talk about the willingness of companies to build warehouses in that state or distribution centers. So it could actually, in the end, help e-commerce businesses and brick-and-mortar businesses, in part because of some of those trickle-down effects. Now, it's up to every state to decide how they'll use the tax revenue, if the states even decide to collect the tax revenue in the first place. But I think this is something worth watching over the next 3 to 4 years to see how it impacts things in the macro overall.
It's funny, as we were recording this podcast, I just got an email from eBay, because I've used eBay in the past, both as a seller and a buyer. It's been a long time as a seller, but I got an email from eBay saying that I should take action on the Supreme Court's internet tax ruling and sign their petition to show the country's political leaders that the new interim burdens could permanently damage U.S. small businesses. And the petition is actually going to take less than a minute if I were to complete it. But this is interesting because this is a huge push. Undoubtedly, this was probably sent to every single eBay user to push back the idea that these small businesses, again, these third-party sellers or people that have businesses that are made up of selling products on eBay, should be taxed and have to abide by every state's local tax code. So obviously, like we were saying, the theme of this story was that it would be somewhat burdensome for a small retailer that has limited resources to be able to decipher the tax code in all of the places that they sell their items. We move on to our third story, and that Dollar General hit our radar this week, but no, it is not for earnings. As they reported last month alongside their competitor in Dollar Tree, two newsworthy announcements though for the company in terms of hitting our radar. The discount chain said this Thursday that they are more or less in dire need of managers, among other employees. Store managers, but also distribution and district operations managers, are needed for their growth throughout the United States. They have long cited a need for store managers here in the recent past. You see a lot of advertisements, even assistant managers, store managers needed for their stores throughout the country. But the need is increasing along with their store base. 2018 looks to be another banner year for the company as they look to open 900 new locations. And you look at a quote by Bob Ravener, Executive Vice President and Chief People Officer for the company. He said, "It's an exciting time to join Dollar General as we seek qualified candidates to support our tremendous growth. Not just manager jobs are going to be filled, but also entry-level jobs as well. 7,000 total new jobs for fiscal 2018, says Dollar General's Chief People Officer. They claim to have over 50,000 jobs filled over the last 10 years. Comparing this year's need with the job placement over the last decade, it is very easy to see how difficult this may be. They're trying to fill 7,000 jobs in less than 1 year versus 50,000 jobs over the last 10 years. 8 to 10 years ago, there were far more people looking for a job. Now, it may be a little bit harder for Dollar General to have the proper placement, as the unemployment rate is now currently hovering between 3.8 and 3.9%, and wages are slightly higher than they were 5 to 6 years ago, both of which we'll discuss in the next story, actually. We have to see that this may be troublesome for Dollar General overall, as some labor markets are a little bit easier than others, but some will require some managers to be temporarily moved to train, and that could leave existing markets, existing stores where Dollar General is doing business now, strained at a time when dollar stores are actually performing quite well. Both the earnings reports for Dollar General and Dollar Tree, despite some hiccups here and there, were generally positive. And geographically speaking, company insiders said that they are still looking to fill management positions in nearly every state that they currently operate in, which is around 44 states. So as you can tell from all of these numbers, it's going to be a tough task for Dollar General to fill all of these jobs at a time when they're trying to increase their footprint dramatically in the United States.
Now, from what we could gather from different sources, the average starting pay for entry-level associates at Dollar General is around $8 to $9 an hour. Now, of course, this depends on location and previous experience, and there are some states in the U.S. where entry-level associates start higher than that because minimum wage is higher than that. But warehouse associates, again, according to different sources, can easily make above that, between $11 and $17 an hour. And store manager salaries can see a base near $40,000, but can top out above $60,000 per year. Now, those wages may all have to go up a bit if they're to fill the current and future openings they look to have for new locations in 2018. Now, currently, the company employs almost 130,000 people in the United States. And let's keep in mind that Dollar General setup usually no more than three at the most employees on hand at any one time in a Dollar General. I've been in some Dollar Generals where they have just one employee overseeing an entire 12,000 square foot store at a single moment in time. And speaking of that, you know, a friction point, a pressure point in Dollar General can often come at the checkouts. If that employee is elsewhere in the store stocking shelves while they don't think there's anyone in line, and suddenly a line develops and you get behind at the front end, making it a less quick than desired shopping trip. Well, self-checkouts are coming to a select few stores in the Dollar General system, and we have a bit more insight as to the plans that Dollar General laid out during their first quarter earnings call. Scan and go apps have been hitting the market for a variety of retailers, but Dollar General will look to be the first to use it in their particular retail niche. It will be called DG Go, and it will be rolled out in 10 Nashville area stores during the current quarter, which is actually the company's fiscal second quarter. They plan to have 100 more stores on board by the end of the quarter. The 110 total stores would represent about 0.8% of their nearly 14,900 stores that are projected to be operating by the end of 2018, thanks to adding those 900 more stores. But you have to figure, if this works, it might be included in new store buildouts as the year goes on. The app will work like a lot of others in that you have to download it and sign in. Their self-checkouts are a little bit different overall because this will only work if you have the app. You can scan the items you're looking to purchase and then scan the QR code that your phone will generate at Dollar General's small DG Go checkout tablet that's near the normal checkout lanes. So it's not as though you bring a cart full of items up to the front, scan it yourself as you would at a Kroger or a Walmart. Right now, there are over 1,000 downloads on Google Play. So far, 4.8 star rating. So DG Go, early reviews are in and are mostly positive. And Leighton, I know you were looking at the online news site, The Retail Dive, that we read a lot from during the course of the week to kind of get an idea as to some different initiatives in retail. They have a great article that just came out Thursday about how different retailers have and should have different approaches. Here we see a different approach for Dollar General. They hope it'll take that pressure off the front of store that's caused by having so little staff. But again, they add an additional step for some of their customers who, and it bears mentioning, not all Dollar General customers have a smartphone. So that could be a limiting factor here.
Yeah, The Retail Dive, again, very good insight as to how this is going to play out for a number of different retailers. They spoke of two dynamics that we think is going to be interesting for Dollar General specifically, one positive and one being more of a challenge or a slight negative going forward. The positive is that the majority of their locations have no produce that you would have to bag yourself and weigh, or any other grocery items that are sold without a UPC. So you tend to think of maybe going into a natural grocer's and getting a bag of mixed nuts that are priced a certain point per pound. They do not have that. Obviously, they have a lot of smaller items. Many grocers have faced this problem over the past few years with not only scan and go, but also self-checkout. You think that customers go in, have to wait and weigh their own items and bag them yourself. And a lot of people like that service that you would get from the conventional side of grocery stores. So one to two cashiers doing the services for them as far as the weighing, the bagging, scanning, all of that stuff obviously has its upside if you do not like to mess with that new technology. Dollar General's items are smaller, like I just said, and a lot of them are not that expensive. So high shrink items that people could try to steal, that is not going to be an issue for this app. Obviously, they do have a lot of things in lockup, such as razors and other health and beauty items that are a little bit more expensive, easier to steal, but you would still have to go to an associate to get one of those taken out and then to scan. So I think there is going to be an upside for Dollar General in terms of that dynamic. The slight negative here, again, I pointed to two things that the retail dive had spoke about briefly. The slight negative would be that the industry experts and Dollar General executives agree that historically, scan and go customers are the ones that fit into a certain demographic. They're usually people that spend more per transaction in their scan and go app, and that has really seen success and strengths in upscale stores and big box stores such as Sam's Club. Dollar General said that currently scan and go orders in the United States, so all of those stores that are currently doing scan and go transactions, roughly twice the dollar amount as the average basket size for Dollar General right now. So as Trent had alluded to, they are looking to sell this to a different demographic, a demographic that may not have a smartphone, a demographic that may just want in and want out, a demographic that is not going to Dollar General for all of their grocery purchases and may not care about using the Scan and Go app for just 5 to 6 items in the store. Therefore, there may be some difficult conversion for someone who is familiar with the app, but then takes that extra step to try it and then also be a repeat customer with it. So this is something that obviously Dollar General is going to try different iterations of, see what works, see what doesn't. The time it takes for the entire process may, in fact, be similar to just using Dollar General's conventional checkouts for the average customer. With all the retailers coming online with Scan and Go, Juniper Research did cite research that say they could see the total amount of Scan and Go app sales to around $78 billion in 2022 or by 2022. That is a lot of money, Trent, but they're factoring in all of the dollar stores that could be utilizing this technology. I'm just extremely curious to see what percentage of retailers are going to be the current ones using it and what percentage of that $78 billion are going to be the up-and-coming retailers that are deciding to use that technology for the first time.
Well, in our final story, the 4th of July is approaching in the United States, and with it, increased seasonal merchandise sales, more specifically pop-ups selling fireworks and related materials that are driving the seasonal sales in the lead up to the 4th in the United States. Now, a few years ago, we had Jason Marietta, who's the retail director for Jake's Fireworks, the largest fireworks distributor in the nation, on the show. And just as kind of a reminder, here's his take on the fireworks retail space, more specifically, just how early they start on planning ahead.
Well, it actually starts more than a year in advance with trying to place the order to China for the next upcoming year. And so, you know, utilizing the ordering process and trying to get all of those things so that China gets a jump on it to then try to produce it, because you have to think about it globally. You've got the European market, which is huge into New Year's, but then you've got Guy Fawkes Day in England, and you had Victoria Day just recently here in Canada, things like that, Diwali, all kinds of those holidays that then China's not just looking at it from the U.S. perspective, but from a global perspective, and so you have to try to get your order in way in advance to then get it out so that, you know, you have fireworks coming in January, February, March, you know, for the upcoming 4th of July season.
He also mentioned to us during the interview that while the fireworks stands you see on the roadside in many cases are affiliated with a company, Jake's being one example, all of the people actually running the stands are effectively retail store owners for those few weeks.
They actually are independent contractors that operate each location, and so they run it, you know, and sometimes it's, you know, a group, it varies there, but they're actually independent contractors that operate the location, and they decide, you know, when they're open and things like that. They basically, you know, purchase the fireworks and then return them at the end of the year. They're running it, you know, basically for their group for that short period of time.
Now, in that interview, he goes on to discuss many different impacts on fireworks sales, from area regulations to discretionary income for families. So we wanted to take a look to close out today's show on how those things are shaping up in 2018 and whether they'll have a positive impact on fireworks sales for the next few weeks.
We begin with discretionary income, and this is something we talk about on the show virtually every week, especially as durable goods retailers aim for large sales of items like washer and dryers, lawnmowers, and so forth. Additionally, we've talked about discretionary spending levels being fairly high, certainly more so than a decade prior. So just where do discretionary spending levels stand currently? Indicators are mixed. MMGY Global, a travel research and marketing company, found that those traveling over the next 12 months actually intend to spend less than they did during the prior year. Expected spending this year of $4,278 per respondent versus $4,281 in 2017 and around $500 more than that level in 2016. Additionally, Americans surveyed reported intent to take fewer vacations overall, the first drop in this particular stat since MMGY Global began asking this question 12 years ago. Travel can be one indicator of discretionary spending, but it doesn't tell the whole story. It could be that people are just less interested in travel and more interested in spending income on other things, maybe activities they could do near their home. One indicator is unemployment and wage growth. Unemployment hit its lowest level since 2000, just like we said, around 3.8 to 3.9% in the U.S. this last month. In May, a year-on-year gain in hourly earnings hit 2.7%. We've been seeing high 1% historically. This is a really good sign if you're an hourly worker. This runs counter to some of the stories we've heard about wage stagnation, and this is consistent with what we've seen over the last 12 months or so, where it has, in fact, been positive. The 2.7% number is much more consistent with what we've seen from retail employers, as they've been having to rise their wages for entry-level workers to be a little bit more competitive. We've seen it with Walmart, we've seen it with Costco, we've even seen it with Target. So the big three there as far as general merchandise retailer. However, we have to keep inflation in mind. The overall year-over-year inflation is around 2.8% now in the United States, ending May 2018. So realistically, wages are just keeping pace with inflation, or perhaps a tick lower. 2.8%, by the way, is the highest year-over-year mark since February of 2012. And one final indicator here, and perhaps the best overall indicator, is the U.S. measurement of disposable personal income. As of April, this number was at an all-time high at $14.86 trillion. Consumer spending also hit an all-time high in April, around $12.07 trillion. And this actually tied into our previous story, and that a lot of customers are not afraid of spending no matter what the taxes may be. But obviously that money has to go somewhere. However, just because the money is there doesn't mean it will be all spent. First of all, and second of all, certainly doesn't mean it will be spent on fireworks.
Now I want to look at some of the weather issues throughout the country that may impact fireworks sales, as well as new regulations in certain areas. Just as important as these local regulations are the weather patterns. Extended periods of drought can hinder the ability to buy or shoot off fireworks if fire weather watches or warnings are in effect. Last year brought about one of the most fireworks-friendly seasons in recent memory, and this is according to an off-air chat with Marietta last year that we had. The guy we talked to at the beginning of this story back in 2016, as a good deal of the drought-stricken part of the Midwest got ample June rain in the lead-up to July 4th. July 4th in many parts of the country was a sunny, gorgeous day, so a lot of fireworks shot off because there was enough moisture around to keep those fire weather watches and warnings at bay. This year, not so much, at least so far. Much of the Midwest has seen ample rain. States like Arkansas, Missouri, Illinois, even Ohio are in fairly good shape. However, central and western Texas, along with the mountain states, are seeing significant periods of heat with little to no rainfall. And in fact, there have already been significant wildfires to this point this summer in New Mexico, Utah, and Colorado. And when we look at these states, parts of Utah have already banned use of fireworks. West Jordan and Park City would be two example cities there. Rio communities in New Mexico, as well as areas surrounding Albuquerque, have also issued a ban. Delta and many other western slope communities in Colorado have followed suit. Pueblo, which is on the Front Range, or the more central part of the state, banned them beginning June 4th. Pueblo, near some wildfires towards upper New Mexico. In Texas, heavy restrictions were levied in Austin. Any fireworks with sticks, fins, or those that fly are prohibited from sale and use through July 4th. Amarillo, which is back in the Texas Panhandle, they're considering a ban as June goes forward. Now, as far as weather-independent regulations go, a number of cities and areas in the U.S. have issued new bans. This includes areas in Washington State, Some, like Port Angeles, are still mulling a potential ban over. Many rural cities in Iowa actually banned some larger fireworks after fiascos from last year. However, the Storm Lake Pilot Tribune reports that fireworks sales at stands nearby are still robust, particularly in rural or unincorporated areas. The story cites Nicole Gustafson from, and I quote, Mr. G's Bangin' Hard Fireworks. I couldn't make that name up if I tried, who says that her sales have not changed, nor has her product assortment since those laws in Iowa went into place. And at the same time, some areas have actually lifted long-standing bans. These include Blount County, Tennessee, where the county commission voted this year to allow fireworks for the first time since 1949. Bill Sharp, who's the owner of Dixie Lee Fireworks in Blount County, was interviewed by WATE in Tennessee. He said the only difference may be where customers are shooting them off, not so much whether his store will see increased sales, as he said he had plenty of customers from Blount County to begin with. So to kind of summarize what we expect from this year's seasonal sales in terms of fireworks, discretionary income is high. However, discretionary spending is still apparently limited somewhat to larger purchases people have been putting off, and not so much leisure purchases. At least that's the way it looks going into July 4th. How the fireworks season does may change our opinions on that. Weather woes, hot, dry areas of the country in particular, may contribute to a slight downturn. However, any weather-independent regulations probably cancel each other out, as they seem to be in equal measure, both lifting those bans and putting bans down. Overall, I think we expect fireworks sales to dip slightly, but not crater this year. Most of that dip going to be contributed to by the weather patterns in the United States.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, a segment we call Looking Ahead, where each week we look ahead at a story that we'll be keeping an eye on for the next week or the next month, and we begin with Leighton.
We look at specialty retailer Ascena Retail Group as they try a new initiative to spur on sales. They've actually been having a tough time as of late. Ascena Retail owns the brands Ann Taylor, Loft, and Value Fashion segments in Maurice's and Dress Barn, plus fashion segment Lane Bryant, Catherine's, and the kids fashion segment Justice. So they have a very big fashion presence, especially tailoring their products towards the working woman. And you see that they're actually trying to save their company with a new initiative, and they're going all in with their premium segment. And they recently saw a same store sales drop of 3%. In this case, they're trying to reverse course and build momentum in their premium outlet e-commerce presence. It's interesting to note, by the way, the only division that did see growth in their entire Ascena retail portfolio was Justice, and they're rebounding from a makeup controversy just last year. They reported recently a positive same-store sales gain of 10%, but this story has to do with trying to have an outlet division online with Ann Taylor and Loft looking to have their assortments listed at loftoutlet.com and Ann Taylor Factory's website is going to be anntaylorfactory.com. That will launch next Tuesday, June 26th. The loftoutlet.com website actually ended up launching on Tuesday of this week. They're trying to, and I quote, find their client, meet their client, where she is, and where she wants to shop. That's a quote from President and CEO of Ascena Brands, Gary Muto. And you see that they're actually going to be promoting a lot of the newer styles that they have and a lot of the current styles they have in store. They said every piece of apparel that they have in their outlet stores right now should be online for their shopper to experience. And I think this is interesting, Trent, because this is a company that has been struggling late. You see it in their same store sales. I am curious to see if this works out. A lot of times you think of an outlet store as having a strictly brick and mortar presence, but they think this certain extension is going to be better for their customer, especially the working woman, where they don't have a lot of time to go to the physical store and shop. They think this online platform is going to take off and do just fine and really help those bottom line and top line numbers for their earnings reports.
Well, my looking ahead story is looking at Sears Holdings. And for once in this space, we're not talking about closures. No, we're talking about a new pilot program that's opened up a mini Kmart inside a Sears store in Brooklyn. This Kmart takes up only about 10,000 square feet. This comes on the heels of the company also announcing that they were going to retry Sears appliances in Kmart stores. Now, a small format Kmart store is something Leighton and I have discussed not only on the show, but also off air before. We've mentioned how Kmart and Sears Holdings in particular has mentioned their enormous cluster of real estate in the U.S., and each parcel of that real estate is larger than what Kmart needs. But as Leighton and I have discussed, there's really no reason why you couldn't see a 10 to 20,000 square foot Kmart have success in the U.S., and there's a lot of real estate in the U.S. if they wanted to snap it up that are between 10 to 20,000 square feet. And it would work well as a get-in, get-out-quickly general merchandise retailer, much in the same way as Dollar General and even to some extent Dollar Tree has been profitable. Despite being in the dollar store segment, Kmart can kind of filter into that variety store segment that Dollar General has tried to corner of late. Now, I don't think Kmart's going to be necessarily adding locations, and this is a decent idea. This is one of the few ideas that we've liked coming out of the Kmart and Sears camp. One thing we do disagree with, though, is according to CNBC, this particular Sears said people were coming into the Sears looking for more of a Kmart selection. Now, believe me, Leighton and I have both worked for Sears Holdings in the more distant past. I can't recall anyone ever coming into a Sears and thinking they were going to pick up something that they found at a Kmart even after the Sears Holdings merger. You pretty much knew what you were going to get. Still, though, small format stores might be the key to saving the Kmart brand. We speak nearly every month to listeners who are chagrined at the fact that Kmart might disappear off the face of the earth. This is one way you might see Kmart be saved. And if it's not a store inside a store concept, you might see some Kmarts, some profitable ones, trimmed down. Now, that's not to say that they're only closing unprofitable ones. In fact, we know of three Kmarts that have been closed in the last 2 years that have actually been the more successful or more profitable Kmarts in the system. And in some cases, there are even Kmarts that have long leases that have just been signed, but they've been closed for one reason or another. Sometimes it's distribution. Sometimes it's just another reason entirely. So this is a way where maybe a successful Kmart can stay open. They can sublet the real estate like what Kohl's is doing with Aldi and maybe, just maybe, be able to salvage the brand in the future. Now, this is more of a rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic type of an issue. But again, it's an initiative that we both like, and it's rare to find a Sears Holdings initiative that we both like these days on the Retail Focus podcast. So we're glad that it's happening. We'll look forward to it taking place in more Sears stores as the company goes forward. Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus podcast. For Leighton Kling, I'm Trent Kling, saying so long for this week. Again, check us out on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast, and we'll see you 1 week from now.
This has been the Retail Focus podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.